Don't forget our meeting with Paul Faulkner next Sunday morning, beginning September the 9th. And you'll have a real treat in store as it continues Sunday through Thursday evening. And those of you who are accustomed to attending these meetings, and almost it seems we have a packed house every night, you can explain to those who've not been here what a thrill and what an inspiration it is. How can we express thanks enough for the gift that God has given Brother Ritchie in inspiring us in the leading of these great hymns of praise, and for Pete McCoy, who led us in such a meaningful prayer, confessing that we are spoiled. I know that you're involved in trying to establish relationships with each other. And I know also that you're away from home. And the newness of the relationships and the absence of that which is familiar, I know must be causing some feelings of loneliness and untogetherness in you. I can't take you back home, in a sense, and I can't perhaps ease the newness of the relationships that you're making. But one thing I've noticed that helps us to settle in is to establish points of common contact with other people around us who are in the same plight. And so I want to speak to you tonight in an attempt to help you find out where you are and where you're going, and also to help you identify with others who are on the same journey. I call our attention tonight to two words, the words lost and found. I think probably that no other two words in the human language bring out such emotional response from human beings as these two words. The word lost can bring strangers together to join hands with people they've never touched to look for a lost child. And the word found will cause people to rejoice and shed tears over someone else's good fortune whom they've never even met. Lost is always a serious condition, even if it's just a ball in a ball game. And regardless of what the condition of the ball may be, it may be ragged and tattered, but if it's the only one you've got, when someone loses it in the weeds and they report the ball is lost, it's sad news in Mudville. And when the one who finds it discovers it, here's the ball. What a great occasion of rejoicing over just an old, ragged, tattered, lopsided ball. But the game continues. These two words are also important when it comes to the human story. These two words, lost and found, tell the complete story from Genesis through Revelation. They tell the whole story of what has been called the scheme of redemption. These two words really are the gospel story in a nutshell, lost and found. On one occasion, Jesus was being criticized for associating with people who were sinners and outcasts. And he told three stories. He told a parable about a lost coin. And he told a parable about a lost sheep. And each of these lost items occasioned joy in the hearts of the owner when they were found. But I'm so glad he didn't stop with talking about coins and sheep. I'm glad he didn't stop until he told us the story about the lost boy. Because not until that story is told do you really understand. And is it really plumbed to the depths? Is it ever really explained or explored what the word lost really means and what great heights of joy, the word found occasions both in the hearts of men and God alike. There's been a lot said about this parable. It's been called the most touching story in human language. I agree. I've never found one to beat it. I know it's the most representative of lost humanity as they stumble around, lost from God, wandering away from Him in sin. I know it describes us perfectly. Augustine said that our souls find no rest until they rest with God, that we were made for Him. This particular parable is what I refer to as a current historical drama. It's current in the sense that it is up to date, it's modern. It's historical in the sense that it can be documented in the life of every individual that ever lived, barring one. And it's a drama in the sense that the emotions of both God and man are laid bare for everyone to see. The stage of this parable is your heart. The principal character in the parable is you. You see, this is your life. Listen to it. There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of your property that falls to me." And he divided his living between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took his journey into a far country. And there he wasted his substance in riotous living. And when he had spent everything, a great famine arose in that country, and he began to be in want. So he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have fed on the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But while he was yet at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to the servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and make merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" See, those two words crop up in this very beautiful story. My son was lost, and now he's found. There are several stations through which this young man passed on his way from his father back home to his father. And I want you to see them tonight. I want you to see if you can figure out where you are. You see, this is the story of the life of every one of us here tonight. There's not a person here who has reached the point of maturity to where he's responsible. There's not a one of us, but what this is the story of your life. Where are you in this story? At which of these stations do you stand? Through which of these stations have you passed? And where do you stand right now? The first place to which this young man came was he came to his father, and he asked for that which was rightfully his. And you know, the young man is not to be condemned for this. His father had provided it for him. It was the Oriental custom for the father to lay up a treasure to serve as an inheritance to give to his children. And this father was like other fathers. He was looking out for the good of his sons. And so he had done this. He had prepared this inheritance for these boys. And this young man came and just simply said to his father, "I want you to give me that part of your inheritance that falls to me, that portion of your substance that falls to me as a son." This young man is not to be condemned for it. He didn't ask for his brother's part. He didn't ask even for his own part prematurely. The young man came at a time that was proper, asking for something that was his by right. And his father gave it to him. And he was happy for him to have it, because it was that which he had prepared for him. And had the young man taken that which he had been given by his father, and gone down the road a ways and set up housekeeping, and led a productive, useful life, his father would have been thrilled to death. This was that which he had planned for his son. But he didn't do that. He selfishly squandered his right. He selfishly squandered his substance in selfish living, self-centered living. And herein lay the problem that is involved in this parable. Now, don't lose the thread of the story here. It's just here that you've got to see a parallel. If this is to be anything more than just a nice story that you'll go away tonight and say, wasn't that a beautiful story? If it's to be anything more than that, if it's to be what Jesus intended for it to be, then you'll have to draw the parallel here and make the application to your own life. You'll have to let your life run alongside of this parable, and this is where you take up with it. Notice, if you will, each one of us at an age in our life when we call the age of responsibility, as we grew up into maturity, as we became young men and young women, each one of us stood before our Father, God, and said to him, in effect, Father, give us that portion of your substance that falls to me as your son. You created me. I want that part of your substance that falls to me. And you know what? You're not to be condemned for wanting that. All of you young people, you're in the midst of it now. You're in the process, some of you, at that young age of saying, give me that which falls to me. I want it. I want to be happy. I want to enjoy it. And that's not bad. It's good to want to be happy. Every human being has at the very center of his being a core desire to be happy. And so he stands before God, and each of us, and this is the point you mustn't miss, each of us stands there at that particular point in our lives. Some of you stood there 70 years ago. Others of you are there right now. Some of you stood there 3 or 4 years ago and said, Father, give me the portion of your substance that falls to me as one of your created beings. And so he did. He gave us bodies. And on the sign out front, it says, I'll praise thee forever, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. He gave you ears and eyes, and he gave you a nose, and he gave you the senses of your body with which you can enjoy, you can taste, and you can feel, and you can understand. And he gave you an intellect, and he gave you a mind, and he gave you intelligence, and he gave you memory, and he gave you vision, and he gave you aspirations, and he gave you all these things that wrapped up together and put into a form that's all yours. There's nobody else like you. This was your inheritance. This is your peculiar part of his property. And he's given it to you in abundance. And here he says, here it is. You take it. And you're not to be condemned for wanting it. And you know, if we had taken that he gave us and just gone down the road a ways and set up housekeeping, if we had taken what he gave us and used it appropriately and used it wisely for productive living, that would have been beautiful. That's what he created us for. Fullness of life. But we didn't do that, did we? I didn't. Neither did you. We have each one selfishly misappropriated what God has given us. And herein lies the human dilemma. Here lies the human predicament. Here lies our problem. But the first place that he came, and I want you to settle it, and we'll pass on. The first place that he came was to his father, asking for what was rightfully his. You have a right to be happy. You have a right to these things that he's given to you. But the second place that he came to this second station, which was the station of the far country. It says he took his substance and he packed his goods and he left and came into a far country. What do you think the far country is? It's sin. There's no doubt about it. I've never read any commentary that said that the far country was anything but sin. But I want to warn you about something here. Don't make the mistake of using the term far country and allowing it to make you think that it's some geographical location distantly removed. That's not what it's talking about. Remember, the stage is your heart. The far country of sin is a disposition. It's an attitude of mind. It's a condition of heart. It represents broken relationships with the Father. It represents strained and broken relationships with the family, and strained and broken relationships with that which is normal. The far country of sin is simply a condition of heart into which all of us as human beings come at some point in our life. This young man came into that far country of sin. You can picture it as he was preparing to leave. His daddy didn't know it, I guess. He was getting edgy. You might have wondered why he was a bit ill at ease and a bit touchy. And you might wonder what was the matter with him as he began to chomp at the bits and want to get out from under his father's direction. He was tired of the restrictions that his father had placed on him. You know the feeling. You know how it is that you're chafing at the bit and you want to get out from under it. You want your freedom. And you can just picture him as he has his bags packed and they're under the bed out of sight. Doesn't want his father to know that he's ready to leave. And he's putting on the facade, making out that everything's all right. But you can see, if you're real wise, you can read underneath some of his answers and some of his attitudes and some of the things that he does, that this boy is really not satisfied to be at home. He really would rather get away. And all he was looking for was happiness. It says that he wasted his substance in riotous living, but I don't believe that that's why he went there. Riotous living sounds so ugly. I don't think that he said, I'm going to go do some riotous living. I think he was just looking for happiness. Any more than I think you, as a young person, would say, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to just let it all hang out. I'm going to live like the devil. I don't think people say that. I think they're just hungering for happiness, looking for something, looking for fulfillment. But the way the Bible describes it here, the way Jesus described it, was that he wasted his substance in riotous living. He wanted to get out from under restrictions. He wanted total freedom. That's where he thought happiness lay, in total freedom, without any restrictions whatsoever. He wanted, you see, to get it all out of his system. Do you ever think, I just love to get it all out of my system? I'd like to sow my wild oats. Did you ever think that? Did you ever feel so bound up inside and so restricted and so confined and you think, I'd just love to get it all out of my system? Not realizing that you don't get sin out of your system by sinning. Any more than you get alcohol out of your system by drinking, or drugs out of your system by shooting it up. You don't get rid of things like that. You don't get it out of your system by indulging in it. And if you sow your wild oats, you're going to have to reap them. God said, whatever a man sows, that's what he's going to reap. And if you sow to the flesh, you're going to reap corruption. But whatever you sow, you're going to reap. There was a friend of mine years ago as a boy. Great, big, tall, fine man. And he was dating a very beautiful woman, a very beautiful girl. They married young. But years later, they had marital problems and they divorced. But before they divorced, this young man began running around on his wife. And she was so beautiful, there was no reason for him to run around after anyone. But he began to run around with other people and run around on his wife and be unfaithful to her. And I was with him one day and I said, Ralph, what's the matter with you? What's happening? And he made this statement. He said, well, you know, Jim, when we were in school, all these other guys got all this out of their system. He said, I never did get it out of my system. I thought, boy, you're a fool. You don't get this out of your system by indulging in it. But this was what this young man was doing. But it says that he was wasting his substance. I don't know of a more graphic description of sin than this. You can look from Genesis to Revelation. You won't find it. Sin is a wasting of your substance. You take, for example, a young man, say at 18 years of age. Something happens to a young man around 17 or 18. He's not a 16-year-old boy anymore. 17, yeah, he's in that transition. But by the time he gets to be 18, everything in him has reached its peak. His muscles are toned. He's tanned. If he's worked out, he's fit. He's trim. He's just got something about him. The set of his jaw has become permanent. He's developed. His head is in a certain way, and there's just something about an 18-year-old boy that's great. Man, I could look at 18-year-old men and watch them run or watch them play ball, and from about 18 to about 22 or 3, there's just something about them they're a glory to God. The substance that God has given an 18-year-old man, it's awesome.
But you take that 18-year-old boy and let him begin drinking. Let him begin staying out late. Let him begin living a life of dissipation and unbridled lust. Let him live as though there were no tomorrow. And let him live as though he were on the Titanic and he's going first class. Let him live like that. And you look at him in 10 years. Watch him when he's 28. My, my. There'll be bags under his eyes. There'll just be a shadow of what he was before because of the toll that sin has on you. It takes such a toll out of your body physically. And if he's indulged in fornication, he's actually spent years sinning against his own body. And I've seen men like that. A young man I grew up with in Shelbyville, Tennessee was like that. And now he looks like my father. My father is in better condition. He looks old enough to be my father. What a wasting of your substance. And every time I look at him, I think, my, my. What a waste. What a waste. I know a young man here in Searcy who, unless he changes his way, will in the years to come very likely have this written over his grave. What a wasting of your substance. Or you take a young girl. To me, there's nothing more perfect or beautiful or precious than a young woman. She's God's highest creation. Man, when he made a woman, God outdid himself. The tenderness of her conscience, the holiness of her disposition, the beauty of her life, both inside and out, the gentleness with which she carries herself, her whole character, her whole quality, everything about her simply says, this is it. This is the highest thing that God ever made. You're very fortunate, young ladies, to be in the prime of womanhood, if that's where you are. You have the ability to create life. You have the ability not only to create it, man has that ability, but you have the ability to sustain it. You carry it in you. You can nurse it. You can nurture it. All of this, you see, is part of the substance that God has given you. I remember seeing on the front page of the Christ Church Star some years ago the body of a young woman slumped on the floor with a knife in her back. And I stared at it, shocked. It was the body of a young woman who had gotten lost from her home. She had run away from home at about 18. And she ran away and went to New York, got into one of the communes there, and began to live the life that was characteristic of that kind of people during those years. And I thought, my, my, there she is. Here she was, lying there on the floor, dead, with a knife in her back. She was pregnant. She was carrying a child. And I thought, here's this one who had the ability to not only be a partner in bringing life into existence, but of carrying it, of sustaining it, of nursing it, of nurturing it. And I thought of the gentleness of her breast as she would nurse a child. And the genuineness of the touch of a mother. And then I saw that body lying there naked with a knife in her back. And I thought, my God, what a waste. What a wasting of your substance. But that's what he says here. He says that he wasted his substance in riotous living. But then the third station to which he came is what we've already discussed. It really is he came to want. It says there came a famine in the land and nobody gave him anything. And that's the way sin does you. When the famine comes, sin turns its back on you. There's always something about sin that it always loses its power to satisfy. You know what I'm talking about. Someone has described it recently as, is this all there is? You know, all that's said about sex, all that's said about this kind of life. Somebody just said, is this all there is to it? Sin loses its power to satisfy because sin always changes. Not that sin changes itself, but sin changes you. You see, sin changes and hardens you. It blunts your feelings. It dulls your emotions. It distorts your vision. It causes you to be twisted and gnarled. And it makes you into something that you were really not to begin with. It changes because it changes you. Sin always loses its power to satisfy. Sin's only product, its only harvest, is want. Sin's only harvest is famine. The pleasures of sin are only for a season, and then comes the pig pen. Do you realize what the pig pen represents in this parable? The pig pen represents that quality of life to which sin brings a person that is actually in defiance of his own natural tendencies. That which is good in a person is actually defied and denied by sin. The pig pen to a Jew represented the exact opposite of what the Jew represented. When a Jew was sent into a pig pen to tend swine, it's simply saying that you can't get any lower than that. It actually has driven him to do that which was against his nature. That's what sin does to you. It causes us to be driven to do things that are actually contrary to our nature. He came to want and hunger. There arose a famine in the land, and no one gave him anything. I can imagine him as he reached down into his bag to have one more drink set up on the counter for his friends while he had the money, to reach in there and not find anything, and to be embarrassed and go to the man at the counter and say, I'm speechless. I don't know what to say. I thought I had some more money. And the man, having set up the drinks, he said, you don't have any more? The young man says, no, sir, I'm out. And then he just simply says to his bartender, throw the man out. And his friends, what happened to them? Oh, well, whatever happens to friends who are your friends because you have money, they left him. And then I can just imagine him going from door to door asking, do you have any work that I could do? And them say, no, son, we don't. There's a famine in the country. Haven't you heard? I don't have enough harlot to feed my own family. And then there came this sadist who said, oh, yeah, Jew, I've got a job for you. Come on, I'll show you what your job is. He took him down into the pasture and showed him a swine still and said, here, I want you to feed these pigs. He came to want and hunger. Well, aren't you glad the story didn't end there? The next station he came to was, it says, he came to himself. He came to himself. Do you know what that means? Do you sense the excitement? Do you sense the anticipation or the possibilities when it says he came to himself? I believe that this is one of the most universal expressions that the entire human language has. He came to himself. I think if you were to ask Japanese, do you know what it means to come to yourself? I think they would say yes. I think if you were to ask a German, do you know what this expression means, that the man came to himself? I think he would say yes, indeed. Or a Russian, or a Japanese, or a Chinese, or a Hungarian, or whatever may be the nationality, if you would ask them, do you know what this means, that this man came to himself? I believe without exception, they would all say, yes, we understand what that means. You see, sin is an insanity of the soul. And when a person comes to himself, it just simply means he understands, he recognizes it, and he comes back to his right mind. And it's as universal as men are universal. It's as universal as people are universal. Do you know what I believe to be the finest hour in the life of a sinner? It's that moment when he comes to himself. It's the moment when that boy who has left his father's home, who has gone into the far country of sin, who has wasted his substance in riotous living, and has come down into the dregs of humanity, and finally, by the grace of God, he comes to himself. Boy, you talking about power packed. Here it is. And you just watch what happened. It was the memory of his father's house that caused him to come to himself. He said, what servant of my father doesn't have bread enough and to spare, and I'm perishing here with hunger? And I suspect that in the nostrils of his mind, the aroma of that bread baking must have drifted through his memory, and he smelt it, and everything in him just cried out and said, oh, I'm about to starve. And all of my father's servants, they're sitting there eating it, and they're throwing it out, and I'm here perishing with hunger. And he made a decision. He said, shoot, I'm going home. And I can just imagine the hurried preparation. He didn't have any mirror down there in the pig pen. The only mirror he had was a mud puddle, and I could just imagine brushing off that old mud and all that old crud that was all over him and looking at it and smoothing his hair, you know. And I bet you he cleared that fence by 6 feet. And the employer said, "Hey, where are you going? You haven't finished your work yet." He said, "I'm through working. I'm quit." But he said, "You need to collect your wages." He said, "I've had about all the wages I can stand. I'm going home." And I don't know whether he rested or not, but the picture is that he came running home. He came to himself. "Man, I wouldn't take a... You couldn't give me all the money in the world and remove from us sinners the ability to come to ourselves, or to remove from us this station in our life where finally, by the grace of God, through some act of providence, through some smell of bread of our Father's house that brings us back memories, that makes everything in us yearn to go back home. You couldn't pay me enough money to have that taken away from me." That's the finest hour in the life of a sinner. The final place he came is came back to his Father. But here's the difference. Whereas first he had come to his Father and had taken that which was rightfully his, he now came back to his Father and was made to accept that to which he had no right at all. Look at the picture, if you would. The son came back down the road that he had left. But the beautiful thing about it is that the Father was watching him. The Father wasn't about his business, other things. The Father was concerned about the son. And the Father, it says, saw him coming a long ways off. I wonder how he recognized him. He was a long ways off. Well, that's not hard. I know my children's walk in the dark. I don't have to see them. I just know the way they walk. I say, "Oh, that's old Dave," or "That's John," or "That's Rachel." Yeah, I know. Doesn't matter. I don't have to see them. Just have to hear them. I once saw my father when I was in the first grade. I hated school. Just hated it with a passion. I didn't like to be away from home. And everything, all this down in here was just in an uproar. And I wanted to go home so bad. The first day of school, there we were. And I looked through the window and saw my daddy 2 blocks away up on the square. And I looked, I thought, "Doggy, that's my daddy." And I shot out of that door like a bullet. And I went and got with him. You say, "Well, how in the world could you recognize your daddy?" "Because I know my daddy. I know the way he walks. Ain't nobody else walks like him." This boy had a particular walk about him, and his father was out looking for him, waiting for him. And here he came, and his request was denied. He came and said, "Father, let me be like one of your hired servants. I'm not worthy to be called your son anymore." But his request was denied. Isn't that awful? Oh, no, it's not awful. Because God had something better in store for him than that of being a servant. And furthermore, he deserved to be a servant. He could have asked for a job. He deserved to ask for a job. He had deserved employment. But his father didn't want him to be employed. His father wanted him to be his son again. He fell on his neck and kissed him much. This is the only picture in the Bible that we have of God running. But you just need one. This is God. The Father here, of course, is God. And it pictures him as running. Running and falling on the neck of a dirty sinner, kissing him much, the scripture says. Jesus described him that way. He knows him. Oh, he didn't want to miss him. There's a story that to me is one of the most touching I've ever heard. It was about a boy who had so disgraced his mother and father and had become such a threat to society that he had to be arrested and put in prison. It killed his mother. She died of a heartbreak. He spent some 20 years in jail, in prison. But after a while, he was being given parole. And the story says that he, upon learning of the date of his release, wrote his old father and said to him, "Dad, I'm so sorry for what I've caused in the way of sorrow for you and mother. But," he said, "I'm going to be paroled on a such and such a date, and I want to come home." He said, "You may not want me. But," he says, "I want to come home. And I'll be on the train on this particular day. And if you want me home," he said, "would you please just put a flag or a rag or something in the old peach tree down in the orchard? And I'll see it and I'll know and I'll get off the train." Well, the day came, and the story goes, and the boy, with excitement, got on the train and was making his way home. But as he got nearer and nearer, he began to be a bit apprehensive. He didn't know whether his father wanted him or not. And as he came near the place, he stuck his head out the window and looked at the old peach tree to see if there was the flag in it, and it wasn't there. Instead, his father had tied every bed sheet in the house in that tree. He might have missed a flag. It might have waved back behind a limb, but his dad knew he wouldn't miss every bed sheet. He didn't want to make a mistake. He wanted him home. Now listen, that's what God did when he tied Jesus to the tree. You see, he could have tied Moses there. He could have tied Elijah. He could have tied any one of 100 of other people there. He could have tied those to the tree. I don't think I would have gotten the lesson. I don't think I would have gotten the point. I think I would have continued right on down on life's train, right on down the track. I don't think I would have gotten the lesson. But when God tied the finest of all the sheets in heaven, when he tied that one to the tree, I know he wants me home. He doesn't want me to go past him. He wants me to come home as a son. And so it was that the father ran to this young man and fell on his neck and kissed him. The cross is that single event where God runs to meet every prodigal and falls on his neck and kisses him much. Now, where are you in this parable? Have you found yourself? You're at one of these stations. Almost everyone here tonight has already left home. You're already in the foreign country. Your attitudes have already severed and separated you from father and mother and brothers and sisters. You're alienated. There's strain. There's stress. There's separation. You're already there. You may very well be in the process, and I suspect you are, of wasting your substance in riotous living, looking for happiness, thinking that it's in total freedom. But the pig pen is waiting on you. You're either already in the pig pen, and look, there's some pig pens with wall-to-wall carpet. You don't have to be in mud to be in a pig pen. I wonder, have you come to yourself? Could be maybe this very night you've seen yourself in this picture, which is the story of your life. Maybe you found yourself. That's where I am. Oh, you say, thank God, I want to go home. There's not anything in this pig pen for me. I want to go home. Let me tell you something. God will run and meet you right now. That's what he says. Man, that's the kind of God that made you. He'll run and kiss you. But you say, I'm so smelly, I'm so dirty, I've done everything. That's all right. He knows that. But he wants you home. Where are you? Think about it. Until you come to the foot of Golgotha, until you come to the foot of the cross, you're still in the pig pen. But the moment you come and lay your sins down with him and confess your love for him and your faith in him, and are willing to be buried with him in that grave which typifies his death, then you'll be raised. God will put a new robe on you. He'll put a ring on your finger. He'll put shoes on your feet. He'll kill the fatted calf. There's going to be more happiness in heaven over one sinner that repents than over 99 rest of them that don't need it. Where are you tonight? Would you come home? You may need to, and this is your opportunity while we stand and sing.